Father, I thank you for just your marvelous power and faithfulness to open our eyes to things as we seek you. And I ask that you would enable me to share something that's encouraging and useful and speaks your truth and love to my fellows here. So I've been reading recently in a book called Voices of Messianic Judaism. And I wanted to share about something that I read recently, and it may not seem super relevant at first, but if you bear with me, God kind of showed me how it was relevant just this morning after I had joked about sharing it last night when I was talking to my dad. So the book is set up as a collection of essays on different topics relevant to the growth of the Messianic movement. And usually there are two or more prominent authors that present different viewpoints on specific topics. And one of the ones I read most recently was about the subject of higher education in Messianic Judaism and the importance of that for leaders being trained up. And the one opinion was that we should interface with Christian and Jewish pre-existing institutions as a way to stay connected to those communities, and also just to appreciate the value that's already there. And also they were of the opinion that if we created our own, we would kind of be separating ourselves from people in an unhelpful way. And I don't want to comment on that, but the opposite perspective of that, which is actually from the rabbi that I had the privilege of attending his congregation while I was in Connecticut, he made one point that really struck me about why Messianic Judaism establishing its own institutions might be very important. And the biggest reason was, he pointed out that in Christianity and in Judaism, those kinds of institutions are often relied upon to kind of set standards for thought and theology and discussion and publications of things in an important way that can kind of speak almost on behalf of the movement to the outside world, like, this is what conservative Judaism thinks about stuff, or this is what the Catholic Church thinks about stuff, just to give a couple examples. And he pointed out that it's very important for Messianic Judaism in some way or another to be able to do the same for itself. And as he put it otherwise, basically any crazy person with a poorly constructed website can claim on behalf of all Messianic Jews lots of heretical nonsense. So how is, I happen to agree with him about that, but how is that relevant to those of us that might not be at all connected to the realm of higher education in any religious thing, which certainly we don't all need to be, and that's not my point at all. But it occurred to me, you can kind of say the same thing about the necessity for congregations and for fellowship of believers and the body to act together in unity, I think especially on a local scale. I didn't have a chance to search out all of the scriptures to have references, but I think we're all aware that scripture very much emphasizes the importance of being in fellowship together, not forsaking the fellowship of the brethren and building each other up in good works and edifying each other and all of that. And it struck me that one of the reasons that's important is that if we don't do that, even though we can trust God to be true and right and speak to us, it's very easy, if we're just off on our own, to get a whole bunch of mixed up ideas about things, that it might be a lot harder for us in our own weakness to tell what's the Lord and what isn't. But when we are in community and when we are submitted to a local authority that the Lord has placed over us and given a share of his wisdom and of his power to help order things and to help communicate his vision and his truth in our local community, then we have something that can balance that out, that God can use to speak something that isn't just what we are figuring out in our own strength in our head, which we may or may not be hearing him correctly at all. And I'm not saying nothing can go wrong in a congregational context. Of course it can. But when we are truly seeking him, we realize that his word also says to seek fellowship and to seek him together and to be submitted to authority in a way that establishes the kind of standard on a smaller scale that an academic institution might establish for scholarship in a particular field. So I just thought that was very neat how all of the things that are true and of the Lord are true on a large scale, they're true on a small scale, and they're true on everything in between. So I just wanted to encourage everyone to really value and never overlook the importance of what we have here together. The second point, which I'm losing track of, so give me a moment. There was one other thing that made a lot of sense as an analogy. So after I had read the chapters, I was discussing some of it with Jerusha a bit, and I don't know much about the subject, but I have the impression that in the Messianic movement, there hasn't always been a lot of buy-in from different parties to the idea of establishing Messianic institutions. Like, there are some people who feel very strongly that that should happen. And then there are others that, you know, maybe don't think it's as important or don't agree about what form that should take. And it's very difficult to get something going that's, you know, that kind of thing without a lot of buy-in, right? And I certainly would hope for the future of the Messianic movement that we could begin to have more agreement on things and more unity and more putting aside our differences to be able to establish things like that that might be important. And so on a congregational level, it was making me think, well, also it's very important for everyone in a congregation to be, you know, whether there are differences of opinion and theology and whatever, it's not like we have to agree on every last thing. I don't think that's even necessarily helpful or healthy, because then it's just like we're all, you know, we could very easily just be a cult if that was the mentality. However, it's very important and very valuable for people in a congregation to buy into the identity and the vision of that congregation in a way that, I mean, thankfully, you don't need a huge number of people and a huge amount of money to make a congregation happen and make a congregation work like you might for establishing a larger institution. But it's still really important that you have people who are really on board and really committed and really understand what it is that the vision and the identity is and are fully supportive of that. And I'm really thankful that we've been blessed in our community with a lot of that. And that's really great. And I just wanted to say that I think that is also very important. And, you know, if God's speaking something to you, maybe some questions or different thoughts about how you're connecting with our vision or the vision that God has for unity more broadly in the body of Messiah. I just encourage you to seek him with an open heart and really think about what's most important. It's so easy to get caught up in little details that matter, but maybe not as much or in the ways that we think they do. So I hope that that's encouraging and helpful, and I'm really thankful for the community that we have, and I think it's very valuable to even just in our area have a congregation that, that has this identity, that's an important one to share, and important perspectives on things, and that we can do so with unity and with a vision that that I believe is from the Lord, and operating with order and power.
Amen.
Amen.
So I'll just throw in, you know, the purpose of movements isn't to be perfect. The reason movements exist is to correct an imbalance. I mean, there can be an imbalanced movement or a movement that's even just of man, but as far as in the body of Messiah goes, movements, generally speaking, have to do with correcting an imbalance. That's not done by being right about everything. There are not groups that have ever been right about everything. That ought to be comforting, because then we don't have to worry that we're completely illegitimate if we're not completely right about everything. If people love each other and put love first, and having compassion for others and judging oneself rightly so that, you know, we don't fall into judging other people, that goes a long ways to get on the right track, no matter what group you're involved in. Because without that, it's all just clanging cymbals. I won't go on about that. Thanks, Noah. We have been wandering into not perky a vote, which would be kind of bouncy fathers or something. It's more like, how do you say it? What is the correct way to say that?
POK a vote. What? Like the word peer and the letter K, POK a vote.
Yeah. POK a vote. The ethics of the fathers. So, I'll just start with that, and then I can't remember what it's called, but there's a complete surprise topic today, which I probably won't spend too much time on, but it's a surprise to me. And I'm just going to try to throw it in with the things that aren't a surprise. So brace yourselves, always an adventure. So here's the next little bit of Pirkei Avot. Antigonus, a man of Soko, received the oral tradition from Shimon the Righteous. He used to say, "Do not be like servants who serve the master in the expectation of receiving a reward, but be like servants who serve the master without the expectation of receiving a reward, and let the fear of heaven be upon you." What do you think of that?
Could you read that again real quick?
Antigonus, a man of Soko, received from Shimon the Righteous. The oral tradition is in brackets. It's not actually part of the text. Received the oral tradition from Shimon the Righteous. He used to say, do not be like servants who serve the master in the expectation of receiving a reward, but be like servants who serve the master without the expectation of receiving a reward, and let the fear of heaven be upon you. Well, like so many things, sticky wickets abound, and let's see, did Abraham work for God to receive wages? No, because one who works for wages, but one who has faith, that's different. I can't quote the passage at the moment quite accurately, but it says in the book of Hebrews that those who, you know, come to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of those who seek him. Also says, I believe, of Abraham that he was seeking the reward, and it says that of others. So I don't think there's anything wrong with the notion of reward, but if you think of your relationship with God and the fear of heaven simply in terms of, well, I'm gonna get paid for my work, in that context, I think I agree with what's being said here. I don't think that Antigonus or any of the others would actually say that God isn't the rewarder of those who serve him, and that they should never have any thought of living in the age to come. But it's more like, would you approach God like, well, you know, I'm going to do this today. I'm going to pray, and I'm going to, I'll be part of a service or something, or maybe I'll, call someone who needs a little help because God's going to give me something for it. Kind of a matter of balance, right? So once again, I guess anything I look at in this, I could probably disagree with depending on how I parsed it, or agree with it depending on how I parsed it. And in the end, in some cases, it might take a better scholar than myself to be sure that it was being parsed correctly. But with that, we will go on. And now I know that most of you are beginning to get your appetite wet for Pirkei Avot, and you're going to want to just really dig into it along with the scriptures in hand and prayers being whispered all along to find out what gems there might be there and perhaps what dangers. Tune in again next time for a little bit more of Pirkei Avot. Okay, so, wow, there's just too much to do here. So here's the surprise to me, part of everything. I wanna talk about anger for a little bit. I'm wondering if any of you ever experienced anger. Does that mean you've been angry? Anyone ever had anyone angry at you? How many of you would say that anger is a good way to start and end your day? If you were going to plant an orchard and anger was one of the trees that you could choose, how many of you would plant nothing but anger trees? But at the same time, how many of you cultivate at least one anger tree that you just kind of want to hang on to? Yeah. Yeah, it can be hard. It can be hard, strangely enough, to choose to plant a peach or an apricot tree that would give sweet fruit that you and your brothers and sisters could eat in place of that anger tree. Because there's something in the anger. I don't know, what is it? Which part of it tastes good? Why do we want to eat off of that tree? Well, I've been noticing as I look around here and there, lots of anger about certain things, just all over the place. But the reason why I'm bringing this up today has nothing to do with the widespread anger that I see people expressing, but I am just going to say that's a real concern of mine. Because when I look at the body of Messiah and I see many people naming the name of Messiah and cursing men and women made in God's image at the same time that they're blessing the Lord, I really wonder what opportunities are being lost in America in particular because of the anger that people have that they feel that they must direct at people that they've decided to view as enemies. Some of those people may actually be enemies. But then the scriptures say that Messiah came and died for us. Well, we were his enemies. So, how should we approach our enemies? How should we think of our enemies? Should we desire their destruction? Should we think of certain groups of people as a cancer to be... I mean, these are among the things I've heard recently. Should we think of certain groups of people being a cancer, they or their religion being a cancer? And if that's how we think of them, then what? How would we go about dealing with what we see as the problem? We cut those people out of society, perhaps pour chemotherapy over them. Or maybe direct a strong radiation beam at them to get rid of them, right? See, because when we start talking about people as though they're something like a cancer, then it seems like we begin thinking of them not so much as a person to be saved from something that they have, a problem, but as the problem itself. So then we could in some way, even without knowing it, begin thinking that what we should do or what would be best is if those human beings were actually removed from the scene. And boy, I gotta say, it's really disturbing to me to hear any person that names the name of Messiah talking in a way that sounds like that. They may not be thinking murderous thoughts, but they are thinking and speaking things that are leading in that are on the same path as those kind of thoughts. So at any rate, but then there's just plain, you know, normal, personal, close to home anger. And it's probably all kind of related. But I don't know if anybody here struggles with anger. It's even harder to see the hands raised on names that appear only as letters. But some people whose faces I can see on the screen are saying that they do get angry. They have a problem with anger, or at least now and then. I've certainly had my struggles with anger, and I'm still breathing, so I don't think my battle is over. But I think so. I'm going to read you very quickly part of the third chapter of Colossians. I'm just gonna start reading. Therefore, if you have been raised up with Messiah, keep seeking the things above where Messiah is, seated at the right hand of God. Set your mind on the things above, not on the things that are on earth. For you have died and your life is hidden with Messiah in God. When Messiah, who is our life, is revealed, then you also will be revealed with him in glory. Therefore, consider the members of your earthly body as dead to immorality, impurity, passion, evil desire, and greed, which amounts to idolatry. For it is because of these things that the wrath of God will come upon the sons of disobedience. And in them you also once walked when you were living in them. But now you also put them all aside: anger, wrath, malice, slander, and abusive speech from your mouth. Do not lie to one another, since you laid aside the old self with its evil practices and have put on the new self, who is being renewed to a true knowledge according to the image of the one who created him. A renewal in which there is no distinction between Greek and Jew, circumcised and uncircumcised, barbarian, Scythian, slave, and free man, but Messiah is all and in all. So as those who have been chosen of God, holy and beloved, put on a heart of compassion, kindness, humility, gentleness, and patience, bearing with one another and forgiving each other, whoever has a complaint against anyone, just as the Lord forgave you, so also should you. Now, I know that some people who are struggling with anger probably thinking, if you could follow what I read, well, I don't think that's helping me. I would suggest reading it a few times yourself, Colossians 3, and you can easily look up in this age of information and quick searches other passages that deal with the subject. But I think sometimes the big problem with anger and not being able to let go of it actually has to do with the way an individual sees themselves. If you have a problem with yourself, if you don't think you're good enough, if you blame yourself for certain things, if you have exceptionally high expectations of yourself, then probably you will frequently find that you don't manage to live up to exactly what you're expecting of yourself. And then you get frustrated and you get angry with yourself. And then you begin to notice that if other people aren't doing it quite right either, that makes it even harder for you to achieve the perfection that you are demanding of yourself in the court of your own mind. And so then their imperfection adds to your sense of being overwhelmed by your own imperfection. And then you just get angrier and angrier, because if they were all just perfect, then it'd be easier for you to manage to be perfect yourself. So then out of your frustration over yourself and your condemnation of yourself, you begin to have expectations that are also unreasonable of others. And so it just swirls and swirls and swirls. And then you need to be around people that don't do anything particularly irritating that might set off your anger. And then if all of a sudden you get angry because they're not perfect, the tendency is to blame them. You're not an angry person. They pressed your button, right? I wouldn't be angry if you hadn't. I would be happy if the people that I live with were perfect. I would be able to perform the way I should if everyone else just didn't make it so difficult. So I want to suggest to everyone, I don't know how you're doing with all the things that are going on in the world, but more and more often over the last few years, and certainly lately, I tell people, be nice to you. Be kind to yourself. Take care of yourself. Give yourself a break. Don't expect yourself to be so perfect. Don't expect such high performance. Be nice to you. Tell yourself some nice things too. And then, you know, it's easier to have compassion for other people if your expectations of yourself are lowered to something that's reasonable. And I'm not saying have no expectation, but don't strive for perfection. Expect God to work, and expect yourself more and more to relinquish things to him and trust him to take the load off of you and help you deal with the things that you actually do need to do, that you are meant to do, that is part of the easy yoke and the light burden that Messiah gives. Because if it's a sharp, painful yoke and an extremely heavy burden, then in both cases, there's been something added to it that the Lord didn't put there. And it can be really hard to just put those things aside, because oftentimes they really do have to do with what we are demanding of ourselves, not what the Lord actually called us to. And, you know, mistakes and misspeakings and goof-ups of all sorts they're a normal part of life. And if we don't judge ourselves so harshly, we may begin to be able to be kinder also to other people. But this is one of the great things, you know, and I would suggest reading the eighth chapter of Romans, but it says, "There is therefore now no condemnation for those who are in Messiah Yeshua." And it goes on to talk about the law of sin and death, well, I could just turn to it. Might be easier. For the law of the Spirit of life in Messiah Yeshua has set you free from the law of sin and of death. For what the law could not do, weak as it was through the flesh, God did, sending his own Son. You know, it could be that in some of the places where we struggle with anger, that we are in some sense, even if it's our own law, trying to do it by law, trying to accomplish things by law. And our own unreasonable expectations of ourselves are a form of writing our own law, but also just expectation that we would perform perfectly according to God's law. You know, the scriptures don't even say expect yourself to perform absolutely perfectly according to God's law. Find me a verse that says so. Yeah, it says be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect, but it's talking about being complete, complete in your heart, complete in your thinking. So anyway, there isn't any condemnation. The Lord doesn't have condemnation for you. So since he doesn't, you certainly don't need to reserve a little bit to apply to yourself like a salve. Because I'll tell you something, if you have a wound, if you treat it with hydrochloric acid, it's going to get worse. That's not the right medicine to put on it. The Lord has oil of healing, oil of mercy, and he can put that on there. But the medicine that we use on ourselves and others oftentimes just eats a bigger hole. So anyway, I'm just going to try to cap this off with this. I know people sometimes, when they're frustrated with themselves, begin to tell themselves, well, no, I really didn't die with Messiah. No, it didn't work for me. No, well, you know, I will point out this, that what Messiah came to do was not easy to do. It wasn't a piece of cake for him. He suffered things. He went through life as a man on this earth, and he suffered the kinds of things that people suffer, but without sin. And if you can accept God's love, accept his judgment that you were valuable and worth buying back out of sin and death with the blood of his perfect Son. If you can accept that, then you can begin more to accept that you actually do matter. You actually matter. What you think and feel and what your desires and thoughts are, they all matter. And who you are and what you are as a human being matters. And God came looking for you as he came looking for the rest of us to buy us back. And He is gradually bringing us from glory to glory and perfecting those that he bought out of sin and death with his perfect son's blood and death. And the power of the resurrection is living in us. And so, yes, we stumble in many ways. And we're never going to be perfect in this life. But we have been perfected for all time in the one sense by the perfect and complete work of the Son. And by, we will come to the point of perfection and spend all of eternity with him. But we can accept our humanity in this present age. So I'm just going to read this from Hebrews chapter 4. Therefore, since we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Yeshua, the Son of God, let us hold fast our confession. For we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses. Do you know that Messiah actually sympathizes with your weaknesses? Is that the same as saying, oh, it doesn't matter, or accusing wrongdoing? Do you know that he actually feels for you in your struggles? He can actually sympathize with your struggle. You realize that? He can feel it. He understands what it feels like. He cares about it. He can sympathize with your weaknesses. And for we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who has been tempted in all things as we are, yet without sin. Therefore, let us draw near with confidence to the throne of grace so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in time of need. So I'm telling you, if you struggle with anger, if you're upset with yourself for blowing it because of your anger, because of your expectations of yourself, because of your unreasonable expectations of the world, your employer, your brothers, your sisters, your mom, your dad, your kids, the world, the governor, whoever, whether it's everyone or just a few people, because of who Messiah is and what he's done, you can come before the throne of grace. You can seek out the one who sympathizes with your weakness. You can draw near with confidence to the throne of grace so that you may receive mercy and find grace to help in time of need. And it could be the unreasonable expectations and anger we have with ourselves and the sense that we deserve judgment that actually could stop us from coming before the throne of mercy to receive that mercy and grace to help in time of need. So I don't know, it's a huge subject, but forgive yourself, please. Ask the Lord for grace. Ask him, thank him for his mercy. Go to him for it if you need it. Ask him to give you more mercy for other people. Ask him to enable you to be merciful with yourself, to be kind to yourself. Consider yourself to be the first neighbor you need to love as yourself. And then it will make it a little bit easier to love the one that's next to you, because it's really, really hard to love anybody else when you got contempt for yourself. And you really shouldn't, because you're made in God's image, fearfully and wonderfully made, and bought with a huge price out of sin and death. So if anybody needed any of that and it helps, then that's great. I kind of feel like it helped me in some way. So, well, that was the surprise. I don't know how much of a surprise it was to you, but time's really flying by here. So, I gotta try to speed things up. Okay. I was thinking a little bit about women. And I don't know if you've noticed about women, but women can become mothers. I've never known it to happen to a man. I guess a man can do some nurturing, but he really can't be a mom. And so in this just sweeping way here, I'm going to mention this one woman. Her name was Deborah. It says this in Judges chapter 4. Now Deborah, a prophetess, the wife of Lapidoth, was judging Israel at the time. She used to sit under the palm tree of Deborah. Wow, she had a palm tree named after her. I hope I get a palm tree named after me someday. She used to sit under the palm tree of Deborah between Ramah and Bethel in the hill country of Ephraim, and the sons of Israel came up to her for judgment. And then you know what happened after they came up there for judgment? She gave judgments. Surprise, surprise. They went by what she said. Try to find the next thing here. I can't read you as much of it as I originally was going to, but I'm just going to point out that in Judges 5:7, it was a really tough time when Deborah came along, when this battle Barak was the commander of. You know, he said he wouldn't go if she didn't go with him, and so she went. As the peasantry ceased, they ceased in Israel until I, Deborah, arose, until I arose, a mother in Israel. So just the most simple thought I want to try to lift out of that is that there was this great victory and righteous judgment that was being handed out, and it was because of a mother in Israel. Wow, it almost sounds like mothers matter. And it almost sounds like mothers can do more than just raise children and bake challah and then maybe have more children. It almost sounds like the world of women, including mothers, can be a little larger than just, what was it they used to say? I don't know, barefoot and pregnant, they would say. Isn't that a horrible thing? It's okay to be barefoot. I mean, that's not the point. And being pregnant is fine. But if women or men think that the only reason for women is for bearing children and cooking dinner, I think it's really too bad. So I don't know how much we can find out about Deborah's children or her husband. She was certainly a major figure, and she was a mother. But I'm thinking also in terms of whether, I don't know, can a woman be a mother without having children? Kind of seems like it. So, as you know, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, I could be really bad with calendars, but I think Mother's Day is coming soon. When is it? It's so quiet in here, man. When is it?
I'm not one to keep track of dates, but I think it's tomorrow.
It's tomorrow!
Oh, wow, tomorrow. It's tomorrow. Well, yeah. Maybe that's why I'm just hung up on women and mothers this morning. I have no idea. So, Heidi Baker comes to mind, and I saw her on something not so terribly long ago. And every now and then, does she have MS? She doesn't. Someone said she did. Anyway, I can't hear you, but I can tell you're saying no, she doesn't have MS. Anyway, okay, forget that. But she would sit there talking about things, and you know, I'm no expert on Heidi Baker, but she's kind of, you know, she's done some pretty significant things. And the way she describes herself, I mean, she'll every now and then say, "I'm just a little mama. I'm just a little mama." And I'm not sure how many people she's a little mama to. But I'll just say, a little mama can go a long ways. So I think I might have to appoint a designated heckler and a designated, go for it person, because it's so silent, it's starting to...
She was miraculously healed of MS.
Oh, she had MS. She was healed of it. Hallelujah. Okay, so I think there is a lot to learn about women. Maybe especially, I don't know, do men have more to learn about women than women do?
I don't know.
I don't know is always a good answer to a lot of questions.
I do not think so. I think we both have to learn from each other. Women from men and men from women.
There is an infinite amount to learn about anything.
Okay, so there's a woman named Mary Slessor that I just want to talk a little bit about. And so she lived from 1848 to 1915. And I'm going to read you a few little bits about her life. This is what it says. When the modern missionary movement came to birth at the close of the 18th century, it was essentially a male preserve. Married men who were called by God to foreign parts took their wives with them, but the thought of a single woman being called to the work was unheard of. It was not until the turn of the century that the idea of female emancipation gradually began to dawn. As women began to emerge as people in their own right. Whoa! Women began to emerge as people in their own right. Did you hear that? If anyone didn't know that, let it sink in. The way was open for them to volunteer as missionaries. When Hudson Taylor founded the China Inland Mission in 1865, he was prepared to send single women into the interior of China to minister to other women. And when Mary Slessor applied to join the Calabar Mission in 1875, she had no problem in gaining acceptance. Mission boards were at last wakening up to the realization that women had a special contribution to make to the spread of the gospel, and soon women candidates outnumbered the men. Huh, women candidates soon outnumbered the men. Mary Slessor felt she had a double disability. Now, somebody just make a guess. What do you suppose her two disabilities were?
Being female and being single.
She felt she had a double disability when she applied to become a missionary. She was a woman, and she belonged to the working class. But by sheer grit, determination, and prayer, she overcame all obstacles and soon allayed any lingering fears there were in sending her out to West Africa, which was at the time known as the white man's grave. So I'll give you a little bit about her illustrious upbringing. How much time do I have? Okay, well, she started out in Scotland in one town. Her alcoholic father lost his job, and then they had to move to a place called Dundee. Their home was one room with no water, lighting, or toilet. There was hardly any furniture, and a bed was a mattress on the floor. And that was for her parents and her five surviving siblings. On Sundays, they were able to escape for a while when her mother took the children to church, where Mary first heard the gospel. From the age of 10, Mary became a half-timer, spending half her day at school and the rest at the mill. At 14, she started working full-time, putting in a 58-hour week at the looms. She clearly had the happy childhood that James Dobson recommends for all children of believers in America, right? 58 hours a week from the time she was 14. So she continued to be interested in missionary work. She got interested, you know, almost, I guess, from the point she came to faith. When she heard a sermon by a missionary from Calabar, and it made a deep impression on her. So, and then she heard about David Livingston. He was her hero. She realized she'd need to improve her education if she was to become a missionary, and started to borrow books from the church library. She also joined an evening class for two nights a week. So then, as things went along, this happened. Her church minister recognized her ability to communicate and persuaded her to help with Sunday school and the young people's work. Later, he persuaded her to speak to adult groups, but she was always conscious of her working class background and became tongue-tied in the company of better class people. I'm hardly going to be able to cover all of this, So she went off to Calabar to be a missionary, and in the beginning she visited women in their homes and taught in school. And she also began to learn the local Efik language and surprised the others at the speed with which she picked it up. She eventually became so fluent that she knew not only the colloquial phrases and inflections, but their gestures as well. So she was there, and then she went back to Scotland for a while because she'd gotten sick. And then on her return, Mary was pleased when she was given charge of the mission at Old Town, which enabled her to put some of her ideas into practice. She quickly became involved with outreach. She opened three new outstations, acted as a teacher and district nurse, dispensed medicines, and conducted four services each Sunday, walking a circuit of several miles. She was at one point designated a female agent. I'm not sure exactly what that means, but I just want to point something out. When you look at some of these people out of the history of the body of Messiah, whether they're very early or later on, whether somebody actually calls them a certain thing or not, I've come to the conclusion doesn't determine whether or not they are that thing. You can perform a function and have a gift, and nobody ever says it out loud, but it's just as valid whether people don't notice or not. But when a woman is in charge of a mission, conducting four services on Sunday, learning the language of the local people, doing all this stuff, I began to get the impression that somebody ordained her. There might be someone on high that does that. That would be God. But so let's see. She gave up a lot of her cumbersome clothes. She wore a simple cotton dress and cotton shoes, and she often went barefoot. She also got rid of her ringlets and wore her hair short. Gradually, she gave up eating imported food in favor of the local produce, which saved her both money, time and money, keeping tea as her only luxury. Probably as a result of her working-class background, Mary felt more at home with the natives than with her missionary colleagues. She found the natives accepted her, and as she shared their difficulties, sought her help and advice. This way of evangelism, she felt, was more effective than preaching. Much of her time was spent in caring for their physical needs, and her simple medical skills came in useful for treating ailments. Invited to cure a dying chief, she was invited to cure a dying chief, but there's a catch. Can you guess what it is? If you're trying to nurse a dying chief back to health and they die, they kill you. So, it says it posed a problem. If she failed, she would be accused of his death, you know, and then wouldn't have been good. So anyway, she decided to try to nurse him back to health. So first she got rid of the charms and the sacrificed chickens around his bed and gave him some medicine. Then with nursing and good soup, the man began to recover. His wives were especially grateful, as some of them would otherwise have been killed if he died. So they told her they too wanted to learn about God and the book. She was often terrified. I'm bouncing all over here. You should look her up and read about her. I got to back up slightly. It's worth trying to touch on some of these things. It says Mary often felt horrified at the way, they treated anyone felt to be guilty of an offense, and sometimes she just had to intervene. On one occasion, a woman wrongly accused of adultery was to be punished by having boiling oil poured over her as she was tied spread eagle on the ground. Mary stood between the victim and her tormentor, her eye fixed on him until at last he retreated. The people marveled at this display of the power of the white man's God. By the way, is he the white man's God? But it's what they were thinking, because she was white and they weren't. And they didn't know about this God. That's the only reason that he was thought to be that. Okay, the death of her mother and sister left Mary free to move further inland to reach the dreaded Okoyong tribe, who were still officially at war with the Efiks. The board finally agreed to let her go there, and taking only her five orphan children, she moved into the village of Akeng. Now, so she was never married, but she was a mother. She had five orphan children, and she took them with her to this dangerous place. And so for a while, she was tolerated by Chief Edom and the other chiefs and allowed to shelter in the women's compound. It was some months before she was given her own hut, a gesture that indicated that they accepted her. She gave much attention to treating illness and teaching the book. Some of the people also wanted to learn to read and write. Then she began some of her more dramatic events where she began to attend trials, and she was allowed to attend them, where severe punishments were meted out. At times, she challenged the chief's decisions and was able to save some from being put to death. The men were amazed at the way she confronted their chiefs and witch doctors, and and put it down to the power of her God. You won't be able to see it, but there's a picture of here of her sitting here with three chiefs there. Maybe you can see it. I don't know if there's a palm tree there, but you know, reminds me of Deborah. She got so knowledgeable about like everything there and so good at the language and understanding the customs that the government began to consult her about issues with the different peoples. And in 1898, she was appointed vice consul to preside over the native court at Akbap. The Obiang people also held her in high esteem and gave her the title Eka Kapukro Awa, Mother of All Peoples. Over the years, Mary often went down with fever and would either dose herself with laudanum or simply force herself to carry on working. As she grew older, she became increasingly infirm. In the end, she collapsed, and as she lay dying, was heard to whisper, "Oh God, release me." When she was laid to rest in Duketown Cemetery, all flags were flying at half mast. I don't know. There's a lot here. I mean, she went into some of the most dangerous places. Many missionaries that went into these places simply didn't survive. Many of them were men. And in this area, it's not that she's the only one that did any work, but let's see. Anyway, what I was hoping to convey is that women are joint heirs of everything that there is to be an heir of in Messiah. And when I look at the stories of some of these women, and I sometimes wonder why I don't know more of them, but I have read of others who just went places and started works when everything was against them and God used them mightily. I don't know. I suppose a really wise group of men could have been standing there all the time saying, "Well, you know, too bad you're a woman. If you were a man, we'd send you." But God doesn't seem to have those same limitations that we do. My point isn't that there's no difference at all between men and women, or no difference of any sort in how one might serve, but more and more I have a hard time finding too much for real limitations when I think of the subject. And anyway, some women end up feeling like there's no real place for them in the kingdom, that they can't really serve effectively or be released to serve because there just isn't any room for women to do that. I think that's a real tragedy. And I just I have no idea what it's like to be a mother. And I have no idea what it's like to be a mother without ever having been married or born a child and take five adopted children and move to one of the most dangerous places on the face of the earth and bring those people to faith and be respected by them and be brought into their courts and be listened to when you stand in between angry people with power to kill and the person that's going to be killed and have them stand down. I have no idea what that's like. But I know that there are women that have done such things, and Mary Slessor was one of them. She did it as a mother and without a man to help her. And I think in many cases without really any men doing much of anything. She is respected by the native chiefs. And man, seems to me she had real faith and real guts and real grit. And by the way, she wasn't always walking around with a smile on her face. It always says that in there. She had a solid, steady faith, but didn't just always feel giddy with, I don't know what phrase I'm looking for, but I don't know the half of what my own mother went through raising her six kids. I have some idea about some of it. My hat's off to her, to my wife's mother, to all of you mothers. I just would like to see men and women released to serve God in whatever way God calls any of them to, and for men to not be threatened by the notion that there are women that can do great things. I'm not sure how obscure Heidi Baker's husband seems. I mean, I know he has a ministry, but it's not his name you hear mentioned all the time. Maybe she sits under the palm tree and he's off doing whatever he does. I don't know. But she's the one that's in the limelight, and he seems fine with that. From what I could tell, he seems just fine with that. But at any rate, it's hard work being a mother. It's and many mothers I've noticed also, at the same time that they're mothering their children, they have to somehow deal with a husband. And I mean, that's an awful lot. So I admire you all. I admire all of you mothers for everything you've done to raise your children. And I want you to know that I don't think raising children is the only thing that a woman can do. I think it's a terrible shame that being a mother has been demeaned in our society. But I think it's been demeaned because women were demeaned so much that some of them felt they had to fight back against the notion of even being a wife or a mother, because they didn't feel like there was any place for a woman to be much of anything else. And you know, however wrong certain things may have been, I think there was a valid desire for justice for both men and women in our society. And I think we've still got a ways to go, and I hope that the body of Messiah can come to the place where it actually does justice to women and doesn't just try to put them in a certain corner that whatever the ideology is decides that they belong in. So somebody make some noise. I'm.
Amen.
Let's all, maybe we could all unmute ourselves and give mothers of all kinds a round of applause.
Okay.
Happy Mother's Day.
Oh, sound. Oh, I'm realizing I was sound deprived.
I'm on mute.
I was in a sensory deprivation chamber. What? Well, the message or messages are finished now for the day. Anyone have anything that you need to
two things.
You're gonna
wait, Paul.
Are you going to close with the blessing before we go into praying for family members?
Yeah. So, you, Lord, make his face shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace. Yivarechecha Adonai ve'yishmarecha. Ya'er Adonai panavelecha ve'ichunecha. Isa Adonai panavelecha. Yasem lecha shalom.